left on the list, I thought I'll be able to finish my notes rather than it's all over. It's been one of those weeks. It's a very busy week.
We can go last. Do you want to go last?
I'm finished.
I'm going to interrupt right now because I just turned the recorder on. So for the recorder, we have Simon Joyce on The Black Box and the Hidden Boat, Conceptualizing Algorithmic Management. Take it.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Thanks. Right, there's actually a typo in the title. It says black box and hidden abode, and it should say black box or hidden abode. So I was really annoyed when I saw it, and I thought, what have those imbeciles of historical materialism done? No, it was actually me.
Are you?
Because the titles got lost and I had to resubmit them, and I obviously wrote the email in a hurry. So it should say black box or hidden abode. So, and I thought, if you can't be polemical at HM conference, where can you be polemical? So I'm going to be a little polemical. So what I want to talk about really is I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about some problems that I think, some theoretical problems with the way categories have wandered into Marxist accounts, which shouldn't really be there without a lot more criticism. Like, and I'm going to talk in particular about the black box and about gamification, which I think are highly problematic concepts. And then I'm going to talk about the importance, if we want to understand work and digitalization, processes around the digitalization of work, we can't just study work. We have to look more widely as well at political economy and at the role of the state in organizing changes in the way work's organized and the way capital is accumulated. So, which is not to say that I don't think technology is important, because I've spent quite a bit of time studying that myself, but this is just what I want to talk about. And I thought as well, since it's HM, you can start with a quote from Adorno. So there's a little quote from Adorno from Minima Morali, which keeps going around my mind recently, where he characterises Nietzsche as the bourgeois critique of bourgeois society. And I think that's... there's an awful lot of stuff around at the moment in the bourgeois, from bourgeois commentators, about the problems around digital work and digitalization. They've realized that Silicon Valley is not Disney World for grown-ups, that there's nasty things about it on all sorts of levels. And especially amongst the sort of American liberal bourgeois commentators, there's quite a lot of critique of digitalization and digital technology and work, platform work, and I particularly, I'm working at the moment on platform work, so that's what I'm going to talk about. And I just think that some of the critiques are quite sharp, but they bring up categories, analytical categories such as black box and gamification, which get incorporated by Marxists into their own accounts too uncritically, without kind of inspecting these categories, where they come from, what they mean, and what their implications are. And in fact, in a lot of cases, we've already got better concepts for understanding the processes in hand. So I'm just going to... okay. So just on the black box. So this is... I'm kind of assuming that in this session, in this audience, people are familiar with this idea that... The argument is, the analysis is that algorithmic management is inherently a black box. That it's inherently unanalyzable. That's where the notion of the black box comes from. It's something that has a long history in cybernetics. The person who mainly developed it in the UK was a guy called Ashby between the 1930s. He wrote his famous book in 1956. It turns out, when I looked into him, you might know this, he wasn't a computer person. He was a clinical psychologist and an enthusiast for electroconvulsive therapy as a way of solving mental illness. And for him, the brain was a black box. It was inherently unknowable, but if you gave it the right stimulus, you'd get the right results out at the end of it. And that's where, and it's, there's a highly problematic history to where the concept comes from. And the way it's been taken up by some of the commentary on algorithmic management, on algorithms, is to say that that these things are inherently unknowable. There's a great piece by a woman called Tina Bucher, chapter in a book, it's actually a methodology book, but she's really sharp. She's really good on this. It's posed as a fundamental epistemic difficulty, these that the algorithms are unknowable. when it's incorporated into analysis of platform work, it soon becomes it's closely aligned to arguments that Labour is invisibilised, which I think is also is problematic. Invisible to whom? Invisible to what? It's not the Labour of platform works. It's not invisible to the workers themselves. It's not invisible to the capitalists who make money out of it. It's not invisible to the law of value. It's not even invisible to the English judiciary. And I'll give you a quote from a judge in a minute. But Tina Booker's really sharp on it, and she just says her piece is called "It's Not Black and It Isn't a Box." So despite the difficulty of understanding what goes on, it is difficult to understand what's actually in the algorithm. It's not that difficult if you look at it in terms of what it does, in terms of labour for platform workers, labour discipline, distribution of work, distribution of payments, and so on. And indeed, I'll come back to that. Those are themes which, the themes of how workers are treated and how much they're paid in particular, becomes important when we think about labour resistance of platform workers. If you want the reference on that, you just grab me afterwards and I can give you the reference. I think we have to be much more careful. I'll give you the quote from the judge. So you can read things by sociology professors saying that labour of platform workers is rendered invisible. Mm. But when two workers took an employment tribunal in a London court a couple of years ago against Uber, the judge didn't seem to have any difficulty seeing the labour of the workers whatsoever. The judge said, any organisation, A, running an enterprise at the heart of which is the function of carrying people in motor cars from where they are to where they want to be, and B, operating in part through a company discharging the regulated responsibilities of a private hire vehicle operator, but C, requiring drivers and passengers to agree as a matter of contract that it does not provide transportation services, and D, resorting in its documentation to fictions, twisted language, and even brand new terminology, merits, we think, a degree of scepticism. So it's difficult to think of a more empiricist view of the world than that taken by the English judiciary. But these judges have had no difficulty so far in saying, here's people, they're doing work and they're getting paid for it. The idea that we can say that work is marginalised, we can say that it's informal, we can say there's all kinds of unregulated, discriminatory, there's all kinds of problems with it, but it's not invisible. The judge's ruling in this is just fantastic, it's just hilarious, but it's very sharp, very funny. The question of gamification, similarly, it's something that's all over the tech media and the kind of the highbrow papers. Not just in relation to work, but in relation to education, health, nudge, all this kind of stuff. I don't have time to go into it at length. In relation to work, so this is the idea that jobs can be designed to incorporate elements of games to make workers work harder. Okay, so this is the basic plot. And when you actually looked at it more closely, the gamification falls into kind of three groups, really. One of it is just things like adjustments that are made to workplace software user interfaces that make them a bit more fun. So that's one category. And it turns out that these don't work very well. It either wears off and they have to be redesigned, or sometimes it reduces productivity because people just like doing the game stuff and don't get on with what they should be getting on with. There's studies that show this, psychological studies. The other places it gets used, the more serious aspects in terms of work, I think, is the term gamification is applied to what are in reality detailed job control technologies. Labour process control technologies. So technologies that measure in detail what people are doing while they're doing it. And the argument goes, this is like a game because people stack up points. You know, if they make mistakes, they stack up points, and that's like a game. And then at some point it will say, if you get enough points, you're fired. Okay, well, that's not a game. Okay, that's labour discipline. It's a complete mystification to try and dress up this the employment relation, labour capital relationship as if it's some sort of game. There was a piece went round a couple of weeks ago about it's going on in a laundry in a hotel in San Francisco where they put in points and red lights and stuff like that. And the journalist who wrote it was saying this is gamification, and the workers, it turned out, called it an electronic whip. I'm with the workers on this. It's not a game. The other point, place where it's comes up is in terms of the argument that wages are gamified. So that recently in the States, Uber announced a proposal to try and retain its longest-serving drivers by giving them a 3% pay rise if they do sufficient number of drives per month. Okay, and this has been described as gamification. In fact, it's a bonus, and it's what we call a pay structure. Okay, there's a long literature on how capitalists organise pay in order to get workers to do more work, to work longer hours, to work more consistently, to remain loyal to the company and not to leave. And in fact, I'd argue that far from this being gamification of work, it's actually jobification of platform work. Every time a platform, especially in platform work, every time a platform attempts to systematise more the way it controls labour or the way it pays labour, that's making it more like standard employment. You know, there's a reason why firms in the early days of capitalism, companies, coalesced out of much looser market relations, because that, in actual fact, for capital, a lot of the time, there are efficiencies in having a workforce who you can rely on and who know what to do. Okay, so that how long have I got, Chair?
You have 7 minutes.
Good, great, that's what I thought. So I think there's a long literature on pay structures and how pay works that just gets forgotten in this incorporation of the latest fashionable liberal bourgeois critique, and we need to be careful about that. There's a great piece by John Stanford that came out last year, The Common Features of Platform Work. So it's platform work in historical and theoretical context. So he says, common features of platform work. And he's come up with five, and you can split hairs, say there's four or there's six or seven. But he comes up with a list. The work is carried out on demand. There's a preference for piecework payment systems. The workers provide their own equipment. There's a triangular relationship of worker, end user, and platform. And digital technology mediates work relations. Okay. And as he points out, only one of these is new. Okay, the technology's new. All the others have been around as long as capitalism has been around. So the triangular employment relationship is putting out. You know, it's the earliest days of merchant capital starting to reorganise production of textiles and other commodities under their control, building relationships with loose networks of workers who were later on put together physically in a factory for closer supervision and maintenance of quality control. But that's, you know, none of these are new. So, and if we delve into those a bit, I just want to, there's some of those that can be emphasised. And I'd like to particularly emphasise the cash nexus. So there's I've been reading the fantastic celebrated article by John Westergaard in the Socialist Register in 1970-71 called The Rediscovery of the Cash Nexus. And I keep thinking I should find time to write something called The Rediscovery of the Cash Nexus. Because what he reviews a bunch of sociological studies in the 60s, such as the Goldthorpe and Lockwood's affluent worker studies and Runciman's studies on comparative deprivation, relative wealth. And basically, they were 1960s accounts to try and... They were versions of the well-known thesis that the class in itself can never become the class for itself. Okay, and they did it by... It was looking at various reasons for the passivity of the working class in the 1960s. You know, of course, we know the timing of how badly they got it wrong. But Westergaard's argument is that all these, the new management methods which were identified in these studies are all undermined by the fact that at the end of the day, the relationship between labour and capital is the cash nexus, the phrase which Marx used as time and time again. And therefore, it is prone to instability. There's the dynamic of profit making undermines any stability which management are able through the way they organise work or the technology they use or their pay systems. It will be undermined as they go along. So it's becoming really clear that the emerging labour unrest among platform workers is very, very often about pay. You know, the big strike going on in Mumbai at the moment of Uber drivers, they report, when they come out of the pay negotiations, report that they've agreed the main rates, but they can't agree the bonuses. You know, it's absolutely, the Deliveroo strikes are over rates of pay and other issues as well. But the cash nexus is coming to the fore more and more in these disputes. And I'll just finish, I've got 5 minutes then, I'll just briefly say a couple of other things. Other issues that are important for understanding platform work that are not directly about the labour process. As Marxists, we need to do more work on the political economy of platforms, for instance, the role of venture capital. So there's some interesting stuff. Kenny and Zeisman at University of California, Davis, have done some stuff on the importance of the restructuring of venture capital markets, of capital markets, for the rapid expansion of platform work in the post and quantitative easing in the post crash era. The argument being that there's a middle rank of the 1980s venture capitalists have got so big they were no longer interested in startups. Quantitative easing, massive amounts of capital available, and some regulatory changes has meant that a new layer of kind of smaller size venture capitalists. Firms, I mean, they've still got a lot of money. They're the ones that are pouring money into the startups. So that there's in the summer there was a dog walking startup in California that I saw the figures in June, July. It had been started in September last year and it was already valued at over $1 billion. They walk dogs. You know, this is the Financial Times has been absolutely caustic on these valuations, the valuation of Uber and so on included. I think there's a question as to whether some of these companies, as to whether their business model is actually ever going to turn out to be based on the production of surplus value. You know, the Uber's not made any profit. You know, it's famous. It's lost $11 billion in 9 years that it's been around. The business model for a lot of venture capitalists is entirely based on share value. So it's invest a lot of money, massively boost the share, the valuation, and then on the initial public offering, sell your shares and make a shitload of money and walk away. It doesn't actually matter if there's a sustainable profit production there. I mean, they're not all like that, but I do think it's something we need to think about. And the other thing I just want to mention is the role of the state. The Financial Times has been, as I said, has been absolutely caustic on some of these business models. It says Uber's only. I mean, essentially, he says Uber. Don't invest in Uber because it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a pyramid scheme where the people at the top will make money and it will crash. I don't know if they're quite right on that. I think it will bequeath those ways of organising labour digitally. But the question of the role of the state, things like institutional capture are really important. The massive role of lobbyists. Uber and Lyft, between them, have more lobbyists in Washington, D.C. than Amazon and Microsoft put together. This year, in 3 months, when New York Council was planning to pass the cap on the number of Uber cars, Uber spent $1 million in 3 months on lobbyists trying to stop it. They previously had successfully stopped this a few years previously. They spent over $6 million. When Uber set up in Miami-Dade, one of its early strongholds, they hired seven lobbyists to lobby a council committee of 13 people who had to make the decision on whether they should be allowed to set up. As Colin Crouch put it recently, the lobbyists are no longer in the lobby. you know, the lobbyists are making policy, and it's repeated at all kinds of levels in the States. Handy, the cleaning company, are tabling legislation at state level in a whole number of US states at the moment to define in law platform workers as self-employees. And I'll finish on this. Some of you might have seen, I wasn't aware of this till yesterday, but there's a proposal coming from the European Commission for a set of regulations on business-to-business trading transparency. Have anybody seen this? Which includes the provision that anyone who works for a platform is a business. Mm. Okay, it's a self-employed. So the triangle, which is sometimes platform user worker, platform clients provider, their triangle is customer, intermediary, and business user. So the person doing the work will be defined in EU regulations, if this goes through, as a business, and that's it. So, and you know, this is quite astonishing that EU has no jurisdiction over the definition of workers at state. That's a member state issue. But on the basis that their argument is that they want transparent transnational markets, therefore they're going to regulate on this. So these issues of the role of the state, so technology matters, but we can't understand work just by studying work, and we need to pay some more attention to these other things, I think.
Thanks.
To wake you up, right? Thank you for coming. Bright colors. It's going to be very entertaining. I promise you. Anyway, so I think it's always entertaining to talk about artificial intelligence, right? It's completely hyped in the news right now. Something that's going to change everything. It's going to be the next internet, the next big thing, right? On the horizon. It's going to change the entire world, and it's going to bring us all sorts of possibilities. It's going to assist us with everything, important word there, and everything, from, of course, listening to music, crossing borders, getting medical diagnoses, even having sex, and maybe even living forever, right? So this is what AI is going to do for us. Should we take it seriously? Stephen Hawking, of course, warning us that AI will take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate, and, of course, then completely rule out the necessity for humans at all on the planet. So we're going to be taken over by robots. So it's argued that robots are gaining more autonomy, individuality, self-driving cars, assistive care robots will become everyday tools in the very near future, for example. Engineers and programmers are beginning to ask, are machines capable even of superior intelligence? And there are cases where machines are teaching us, quote-unquote, I'll refer to that in a couple of minutes. So the relationship seems to be changing. Will we become like resources for robots instead of the other way around? So what we're trying to do in the research that I'm going to present today is to take a step back, identify why now, what is it about our current political economy, mode of production, social issues, to identify whether artificial intelligence, in the case of this stuff, has implications for the workplace. Is it something we've seen before? Is it something new? And of course, to theorize that on the basis of how it determines things to do with, for example, surplus value of labor and the surplus population for workers. So this kind of stuff. But the debates now in the 21st century, what I'm going to do is to tell you about the fierce debates now. Why is it that this is making headline news? By talking a little bit about the history of artificial intelligence. Why now is there so much funding in research and development? Why there are a lot of grant schemes you may have come across specifically asking people to look at this? How is this going to change, the kind of the entire horizon of our existence? So I'm going to talk today a little bit about the history of AI, and then I'm going to mention a little bit about some of the practices of integrating artificial intelligence into workplaces, which is part of a report that I just managed to submit last, Wednesday. I submitted it, I think it was on Wednesday or Tuesday, which outlines where I'm finding the most prevalent examples of the integration of artificial intelligence into workplaces. That includes manufacturing, factories and warehouses, that involves office spaces, that involves things to do with gig work, as Simon's just outlined, platform work. And also the uses in human resources, which is very important. That's an EU agency on safety and health. So what I'm doing is covering exactly where risks are already evident and what the possible future risks are. But as I mentioned to you already, this is going to be more entertaining. So we're going to go into antiquity and the history of anthropomorphizing machines, because it's important when talking about artificial intelligence, what is intelligence and what is supposed to be artificial about, right? So we're going to do a little bit of philosophy, and Frank is going to pick up on that a lot more in just a minute. But the history of anthropomorphizing machines and a social fascination with mechanization, body augmentation, sentient robots, yeah, even in Greek mythology, we had Talos. I put a picture of him here. Talon, he's a giant automaton made of bronze to protect Europa, in fact, in Crete from pirates and invaders. So he was actually going to protect you, this kind of huge, in a way, humanoid. So in 1770, you had the Mechanical Turk who played chess, and of course won against Napoleon Bonaparte, and then this turns out to be an elaborate hoax, okay? So again, this kind of history of the fascination. During the Victorian era, aristocratic families would enjoy experimentation and the invention of quirky automatons. There was a tiny wind-up mechanized waitress that they would wind up and have go around the banquet tables with a glass of wine sitting on her head. And then where she would show up in front of whom was always seen as something very intriguing, right? So again, this kind of relationship of mimicry in a way, mirroring the human soul? What are we expecting from these machines, as it were? And more recently, of course, you have a number of films capturing themes. Even before the term artificial intelligence is even imagined, like Metropolis, 1927, Dan Heer-De Welt in 1934, Westworld, of course, 1973. So people are gazing upon machines as mirrors, seeking to perfect our understanding of supposedly our own inner workings and subjectivity. And look at the ideas of human capabilities. Can these extend beyond what we have now by becoming more supposedly intimate with machines, or mirroring ourselves in that context? So is it augmentation, or is it just this kind of more distant relationship? But outside of popular culture, the creation of course, and then we go into the history of technology, electronic digital machines, which now follow syntactical rules and operate on data, where the need for interpretation and intervention supposedly becomes increasingly minimal with AI. It can't be studied without investigating the history of thinking, the philosophy about the nature of reason, and again, the relationship between humans and machines and measure. Okay, so the mind is seen to operate ontologically via quantification in the history of Western thought. So for example, Thomas Hobbes in Of Science and Reason, so this is part of Leviathan, this is how far back we're going to try to take this. He muses, when a man reasons, he does nothing but conceive a sum total from the addition of parcels, for reason is nothing but reckoning. So Hobbes was convinced that humans' capacity for reason, which of course animals don't have, is a process whereby we simply carve the world into symbolic units and we use sums to make decisions informing our intentions. So this is supposedly the way that the mind works. This is important when we try to say what is artificial about intelligence. I think you understand why I'm doing this. Okay. So man can consider the consequences of our actions, supposedly make theories and aphorisms, reasoning and reckoning, not only in number, this is from Hobbes again, but in all other things whereof one may be added unto or subtracted from another. So in the beginning was the Word, supposedly. This is the first sentence in the Christian Bible, the Book of John, tells us this, but perhaps the statement can be reformed now and talk about it supposedly in the beginning. What am I going to say? In the beginning was the number. Okay, I love this. So machines don't stand in isolation then of social circumstances, and this is what we're trying to say, and political economy have for millennia been incorporated into workplaces, used to valorize living labor and socialize other machines. To socialize ourselves, to model workplaces, to supposedly model minds. So now as encounters with machines become increasingly intimate and are used to make calculations about our capacity to work, for example, our eligibility for being hired, happening in people analytics, our worthiness for credit, soon perhaps our eligibility maybe for basic human rights. So with the growing interest in AI and intimate processes, it appears that machines are becoming supposedly direct competitors with us for decision-making powers, work, and intelligence itself. So Marx observed during his lifetime the ways in which early industrialization turned living labor into a mere living accessory of this machinery as the means of its action, posits the absorption of labor process in its material character as a mere moment of the realization of capital. You'll be familiar with these quotes. So Marx talks about how the worker may appear then superfluous beside machines, as machines abstract, quantify without labor. So AI now, which is seen supposedly as the pinnacle of machine capability, it refers to computer's programs, which are able to behave supposedly in a way that, if demonstrated by humans, would be considered intelligent. Now, this question around to what extent we are making a direct comparison informs the debates over time in how artificial intelligence looks and is discussed. So while humans apparently train AI with the use of big data right now, I'm wondering, will machines begin to train humans to be helpless, and will humans become the resource again for machines? Ultimately, if machines mimic the nuances of experiences and human judgment, will they become participants in humans' supposed learned helplessness? Right? That's from Sullivan. Okay. So here we identify some of the insights over time of various thinkers in the lead up to now what we think of as AI, to reason what does it mean to talk about human intelligence, considering the significance of the types of technologies that were invented, the ways that they begin to socialize around themselves through impacting how we believe a human mind can work, and also by the use of living labor to perpetuate capitalist employment relations. So the first invention of this kind of machine, which helps us to think about this increasingly intimate relation between machine and human, is the analytical engine, 1835. It's probably a good place to start because this is the beginning of supposedly thinking, emergence of supposedly thinking machines. So this was never built. The engine was the first imagined digital computer, so punch cards allowed for the operation of logical and mathematical computations. These differed, in fact, from analog computers, which measured only magnitude and physical quantities like, that is, qualities like voltage, duration, angle of rotation in proportion to the quantity to be manipulated. So the word digital is important in this space because, in fact, it's the Latin word for finger. So if you think of a finger as a discrete unit, the choice of what counts in this context matters. So which discrete unit is selected to obtain a result? Okay, this is a point that Henri Bergson, to some extent, deals with as well in Time and Free Will. He queries methods that attempt to measure intensities of sensation with quantitative means, again, as though each unit of measure can be seen as identical, as well as building on previous amounts. So there's a querying around what quantification can mean, and I think we need to do this to take this kind of supposed next huge phase of technological and social improvements to task. So while most of the thinkers who set up the stage for thinking about thinking were men, one woman stands out during this early phase, the Countess of Lovelace, so of course, Ada Byron King. She wrote the first algorithm, in fact, that was part of the design and the invention of this analytical engine. And during her 36 years, she was seen as the first to perceive the full possibilities for computer programs. Another predecessor, we have George Boole of Boolean Algebra and the Laws of Thought. He indicates that all reason is calculating, again, supporting this idea that thought can be reduced to numbers, symbols, and ultimately quantification. So a century later, who do we have? 1950, Alan Turing. This is, again, before artificial intelligence, the term is used. He publishes this important essay, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, which introduced, of course, the test, the imitation game. So this game was designed, in fact, to identify whether machines could behave like humans by seeing whether humans could tell the difference between humans and machines. In the essay, he writes, "The present interest in thinking machines has been aroused by a particular kind of machine, usually called an electronic computer or a digital computer." So Turing, and I find this very interesting, he's one of the only modern thinkers, in fact, to look critically at the words thinking and machine, decides in the essay it's perhaps more important to inquire whether humans can be fooled by a machine into thinking that a machine is a human than it is to seriously ask whether or not machines can themselves think. He's also one of the early scholars to draw a fairly sharp line between the physical and the intellectual capability of a man. He argues that, in fact, in this essay, that no engineer and no chemist has yet produced any materials that convincingly mimic the skin. This is very important. Of course, I've written quite a lot on Spinoza and the kind of modes of dualism, this kind of stuff. So this particularly interests me. While Turing doesn't go deeply into the insights, like to inquire ontologically to what extent bodies and minds are intertwined in the intellectual life of a human, for me, it's very interesting that a man whose sexuality was punished by society during his lifetime and his considerations took him into this line of reasoning. and questioning like no other in these early days. Okay, but the history of actually termed artificial intelligence happens just a few years later at an academic conference like the one you're at, which were in fact a series of workshops led by an assistant professor, his name was John McCarthy. He worked with a few other men. And what they decided was we can run a workshop over a few series of, you know, weeks during the summer, as they put the proposal forward to the Rockefeller Foundation. And they said we, in a few sessions, can make a machine behave in ways that would be called intelligent if humans were still behaving. So he uses the term AI, artificial intelligence, differentiated from cybernetics. And soon, despite the perhaps more like because of its overlaps in research question, the field of AI overtook cybernetics in fact altogether. Anyway, the subsequent so-called symbolic approach to AI involved attempting it in the very early stages to mimic the logical processes of the brain. So this is the era we now call GoFi, so good old-fashioned artificial intelligence. It's very important that in these very early stages, the idea was that we can really mimic how the mind works, which of course then means we have to know how the mind works. Okay, so how does it work? And then you see this kind of rationalist, kind of very logical implications that come out of, and then his critique later for being very much in the Descartesian tradition, without taking the more qualitative, without looking at this a little more critically. But the term itself flourished in popularity. And a recent book by Jerry Kaplan, who speculates, this is quite good, that the improbable success in attracting interest goes beyond the academic roots. I like this because he says, look, if the airplane were called an artificial bird, for example, imagine the subsequent confusion in watching the progress of the invention of the wing and so on. So intelligence is artificial, of course, is quite a seductive concept. And calling AI symbolic processing or analytical computing, for example, wouldn't have had the same impact. Nonetheless, in this first period, the physical symbol system, the PSS, which is also called the formal system, this is envisaged by Ewell and Simon, who are the two supposed godfathers of AI, as well as a few others. And these systems were supposed, argued to be the first to have the necessary and sufficient means for general intelligent action. So PSS relied on rationalist fundamentals, logical assumptions in the tradition of Descartes, Hobbes, Leibniz, Kant, and Hume, where one must have abstracted a theory based on invariant features and specific situations to deal with the domain. So the claim then is that PSS has the means for general intelligent action, and if this was based on an understanding of how humans think, i.e. that we only carry out symbolic manipulation, if that's right, then of course a machine can be intelligent, right? Now, this came up a lot with some problems, as you can imagine. So the piece that I'm working on looks at the types of robots that were invented, the types of machines. The problems come about because of this concept around representation dealt with particularly in Hubert Dreyfus's work, where he was very critical and he really interrogated the work that was going on at MIT. And began to ask questions from the Heideggerian perspective. But the machine's intelligence required making supposedly appropriate inferences from seemingly internal representations, where if this symbolic system were seen to work, then we would have everything we possibly need. But the reasoning sits alongside more recent idea than that machines should be fully autonomous. And then anyway, you've got the invention of the neural network. I'm not going to go into this very much because my time will unfortunately not last. But then in the paper, we're looking at Joseph Weizenbaum, who in 1966 invents the first kind of what we see now as a chatbot. So this is Eliza. This is again very important because his interest again was to see how humans respond to a machine and this sort of emotional responses. Also named after an ingenue, which is from Pygmalion, who is herself a kind of a therapist. So really this chatbot is set up very at that point as having an assistive capacity, but yet Weizenbaum himself is very skeptical about this. What does this mean in terms of the dark side for Earth? Well, as he was looking at artificial that gives me at least one more second. Okay, that was easy. Okay, let's do this. I've done this slide to show you the history of the invention of specific technologies and also the kinds of debates that have gone into it and why we're now in the supposed AI phase. And then empirically, just to give you a sense of how we're going to start talking about the political economy aspect, to look at how artificial intelligence is being integrated into workplaces, and is potentially the next phase for how to extract surplus value of labor, potentially, or to create the surplus population. So this is coming out of the report that I've just submitted again to the EU agency, where I'm looking at the human resource aspect. This is very important because the use of machine learning with algorithms that, of course, fed existing big data allows for supposedly quite unbiased decision making. Okay, so this phase, and I haven't been able to go through, that's okay, the different phases for discussion around supposedly how we expect machines to think supposedly and how they can be play a role in specific environments, and if it is the workplace, we're coming up against a lot of issues to do with questions around, let's say, liability, let's say the kind of health and safety issues that are in, emerging in the workplace, the risks, as I've written for them here, occupational safety and health, micromanagement, unfair and illegal discrimination, de-skilling and psychosocial violence, and of course reduced management, and the list goes on. But there are various ways of integration, the use again of chatbots, you've got cobots, drones, wearables, block size production. So the capacity of the machine for intelligence is supposedly still within this domain of supposed measure, quantification, discernment, and discretion. And so what we're trying to do, and this is some work I'm doing with Frank as well, is to really put sort of brakes on this and say philosophically, what does this mean for where we are up to in terms of our relation with machines, and how much I would say authority we're willing to give. And that's it. Thank you. Problems faced by artificial intelligence, but I think I sort of alluded to most of them. One of that I'm very interested in is the affective labor question, and I really do want to, again, really interrogate why, when we're discussing AI, the bodies are left out usually, which reflects how the kind of rationalist thinking that I referred to at the beginning of my talk proceeded, and these kinds of things. But you can read the paper as soon as it's ready, and here's my report, and here's some beautiful photographs, and that's my recent book. That's it, really. Thank you.
Done.
Thanks very much.
Okay, we better move right on to Frank. So we have Frank Pinster on the production of intelligence by capitalist mediation.
Yes, so after the more empirical actual part of Simon and the more historical overview of Phoebe, I do the more philosophical part. The question is, what is AI? The production of intelligence by capitalist mediation. In a difficulty in the path of psychoanalysis, Freud in 1917 declared that humanity has suffered three historic humiliations. The first was the cosmological humiliation of Galileo's discovery that the Earth was not at the center of the universe. The second was the biological humiliation by Darwin's discovery that mankind was the result of an evolution instead of God's creation, and that man is of the animal instead of God's kingdom. And finally, the psychological humiliation by Freud's own insight, namely that we are not in control of our own minds. I quote, "Psychoanalysis confronts consciousness with the embarrassing insight that the ego is not master in its own house," end of quote. It became common to add Marx before Freud, as Marx showed that we are not able to control and not even capable to fully understand our own mode of production. Mankind, hence, does not understand the form of its own socialization. With artificial intelligence, AI, it seems that actually there is a new form of humiliation. In 1996, Deep Blue beat the world's best chess player at that time, Garry Kasparov. In 2011, IBM Watson won live on television a Jeopardy clash, and in 2016, AlphaGo beat the best Go player in the world. Has with these victories artificial intelligence surpassed or even overtaken human intelligence? Is this the final humiliation of humankind? The answer is yes, AI has overtaken us.
But ironically, in the same way, human intelligence already has been taken over by artificial intelligence, has already been taken over by an artificial intelligence that humans themselves have constructed, but in an unconscious and unwilling way. So the question of my talk is, how do we have to understand this quandary situation humans are in? Why we are humiliated right from the beginning? To come to an answer, as Phoebe already suggested, we have to start with the question, what human intelligence is? The critical core in regard to human intelligence has been already there in the philosophy of German idealism, namely to think the human, and with the human also intelligence, from outside the human, from somewhere else, but neither from a god or from nature. There is nothing ideal, religious, natural, or empirical at all that can explain human intelligence. Kant and Hegel rather pointed to a negative essence of mediation between subject and object, which must constitute what it mediates. According to Kant's critical insight per se, objectivity is uncircumventably always already constituted by a transcendental form of subjectivity, while Hegel wanted to overcome the dualism in Kant by thinking subject and object from a mediation that is their speculative identity, and this mediation falls into the logic of the notion and the spirit. Marx finally noted that mediation has to be thought as a social and historic specific mediation, which however seems to have, like in German idealism, a quasi-ontological or transcendental, or in Hegel's case, even an absolute status. Yet, it is precisely this status that needs to be turned out as a second nature produced by capitalist mediation. This second nature is exactly what needs to be developed as a kind of artificial intelligence. But if the subject and its intelligence have to be thought from this AI, then the subject must be right from the beginning a divided and split subject. The subject is subtracted and at once attracted by an over-individual other which functions like an AI and is precisely responsible for what in the subject is intelligence and makes it right from the beginning an interface. What goes for the subject goes for its means. What makes the means of production productive is their character as an interface with the same AI they like humans embody. This entanglement with AI comes to itself in the means of production per se, the machine. A machine is, as Heidegger, Simondon, or Deleuze, Guattari pointed out, nothing without its context, without its interconnection with other machines, and without their entanglement with the human. This entanglement led indeed to the idea of man as right from the beginning a individuum or a man-machine. So the very first act of AI seems to split both humans and machines, to open them for their mutual mediation, making each of them an interface, while the AI itself disappears and in this entanglement and appears as a property of individual humans and of individual machines. Okay, to sum it up, to understand AI, I think we have to develop these two characteristics. First, AI as a supra-individual form of social and specific capitalist mediation, which, second, produces human and machinic intelligence as interfaces to the capitalist society and entangles them. Decisive is that this character as interfaces and this entanglement of man and machine is not mutual without a common excluded third, which is their blind spot. And this blind spot is what we must develop as artificial intelligence. Of course, I can only sketch out here a kind of program. To show at least the starting point of such a program, I want to show how we can use Marx to socialize what already in the philosophical self-understanding of our society was at stake, especially in Marx's famous materialist turn of the Hegelian spirit. There are in the history of Marxism two main lines of interpretation of this materialist turn. The first strain is called classical or traditional Marxism and was dominant in the Marxism that had already begun in Marx's time. To put it simply, the general assumption here was that what Hegel presented as spirit in reality is human labor and social practice. Marx materialism deciphered in the Hegelian spirit alienated forms of a human essence that lies in praxis, especially in the social determination and productive power of human labor and its metabolism with nature. The other strain to interpret Marx's materialist turn and the socialization of reason and spirit is more philosophical and categorical. It is present in Western Marxism, critical theory, and actually in post-Marxism. It brought a more negative critique, often taking explicit distance to the shortcomings of the other strain, and it brought in the opposite pole of that of labor, production, and metabolism with nature, namely that of the form of social mediation by exchange and commodity form, by circulation and valorization. Decisive for both strains, however, is that there is in fact a socialization of labor, of its means, and of the society in general going on. But while in the strain of classical Marxism, this socialization is done by labor and its metabolism with nature, in the other strain, it arises from within the mediation of society with itself, namely by the commodity form and value form. And while in the first strain, the supra-individual subject produced by this socialization is the proletariat, in the second strain, the subject that arises from the form of capitalist mediation and valorization is capital. I think we can indeed combine the critical content of both strains. On the one hand, the traditional Marxist idea of a socialization of humans, their means, and the society in total by labor, but split by the contradiction of this labor with capital. And on the other hand, the idea that value form and capitalist valorization is the real subject coming out of this socialization. But both strains of Marxism overlook the crucial point of our socialization. It is money. Although the second strain saw the form of socialization in social mediation by commodity and value form instead of labor and its means, also this strain overlooked the importance of money for the socialization of humans and machines. The crucial point is that money and capitalism not only becomes the form to socialize, like a kind of artificial but at once all too human intelligence, humans and their means of production, but this form becomes in fact something like a machine. In money, an overarching socializing machine is in force, socializing humans and their labor on the one hand, and their means on the other, especially all the individual technical machines. So we have two types of machines. We have all the different technical machines in our social production, and we have one big single overarching social machine with money, the one machine to rule all the other machines and the whole mode of production as such. If you want to understand the entanglement of these two types of machines, we have to look how the technical machines are productive in a valorization that works by the social machine, namely by the functions and circles of money. Marx is clear and simple here. The technical machines, whatever they on a technical side do, mechanical movements, calculations, or self-learning, technical machines enter in a production that is a pure quantitative relation and valorization. And here, in this quantitative valorization, machines do always one and the same thing. They reduce necessary labor time and convert it into surplus labor time. In other words, according to Marx, the machine is not productive, as it seems, because it produces more or better goods. It is productive because it converts necessary in surplus labor time. This conversion, although it seems a plain and simple thing, is nothing less than the socialization of the whole production, because according to Marx, the production of surplus labor time is a social process that includes all the different capitals, all the works done, and all the commodities produced. This is because the reduction of necessary labor time not only reduces the values of the various commodity produced, it reduces the costs of the one and only productive commodity. reproduced by all these various commodities, namely the commodity labor power. And for this circle of reproduction, all the individual capitals must come together, especially in the form of relative surplus production. This relative surplus production is also where machines are productive. How this conversion by machines and this relative surplus production exactly functions is not decisive here. Decisive is that to bring the whole production together and form a reproduction circle is what the social machine money does. So this is crucial if you want to elaborate capitalist money as a kind of artificial intelligence. To bring all the technical machines, all the human labor forces, and all the produced commodities together as pure quantitative values, and to set them in a common productive valorization process, we need the social machine money. We can show their joint socialization by the different generations of technical machines on the one hand and the social machine money on the other. These generations mark different capitalist stages of the socialization. What first regards the generation of physical machines, starting with the famous steam machine and leading to the big industry, here the machines socialize the working class by formalizing labor and its conditions of living, homogenizing the working class and their life forms and concentrating them in big factories and cities, but also in their political representations like huge socialist and social democratic organizations, unions and parties, etc. This is why the idea of a social and political subject was often identified with this kind of an industrial white male working class, although it seems now that this kind of a homogeneous composition was a historical episode only produced by these industrial types of machines. This became clear by the next technical revolution brought by calculation machines, leading to cybernetics, digitization, the internet and algorithms. These machines socialize the capitalist society in the opposite direction, namely by an individualization, decentralization, and dispersion of labor and their means, leading to a kind of post-Fordist, post-industrial society. This is why the social subject now is rather thought more as the multitude, general intellect, collective intelligence, etc., rather than a homogeneous white male industrial working class. Just like capitalism is no longer called industrial and Fordist, but digital capitalism, knowledge capitalism, etc. What regards now the money machine, we could assign to these different technical machines and their forms of socialization respective historical forms of this social machine money and its forms of capitalist socialization. In the industrial age, money was concentrated and fixed in factories and huge machine parks, circulating products of material mass consumption or, in war times, when money became a war machine, of mass destruction, just like the physical machines turned their power into forces of mass destruction. In this industrial age, money was mainly a socialization of mass production and industrial infrastructure and of this production. Today, in the era of calculation machines, money is concentrated and fixed in high-tech companies and their algorithms and platforms, research hubs, etc., which socializes information, data, etc., to turn them into conditions of valorization. But money is also flowing and circulating in a liberated finance market with all the forms of credit and risk, finance, and fictitious capital. In these forms, the money machine functions more just like the calculation machines, by controlling, operating, and governing physical machines and the whole production process than by really entering in the means of industrial commodity production. These forms that are derived from capitalist valorization become more and more important for our socialization. With credit, money socializes past and future profit. With fictitious capital like stocks and state bonds, it socializes private property. With derivatives, it socializes risks of capitalist production, and so on. So the big question now is what kind of socialization the machines of artificial intelligence will bring. AI is neither an attraction and concentration of mass workers, nor their individualization and dispersion. AI instead is the machine tool, and this is my thesis, to socialize all the other machines and by that also humans. AI is about socializing all the technical and calculation machines already in force, but till today only connected as single machines with no internal communication, no self and deep learning competence. Yet they will socialize all things and all humans by connecting them with chips, sensors and other interfaces to the internet and to let them communicate, processing their data by self-learning algorithms. This socialization of machines is also why the internet and big data are so important, and this is why AI is socializing us by becoming part of our social infrastructure. But this is only the technical side of AI. This socialization of machines will deal with all kinds of technical problems and will possibly find technical solutions. But this technical side of AI will always be an interface with the non-technical and pure social side, with a valorization process enforced by the AI we individuated in the money machine. Decisive, therefore, is what the technical side of AI will mean for this valorization, and here I think AI will not solve the problems it will actually contribute to. I think we can rely here on the experience that already critical theory claimed in the Dialectic of Enlightenment. Every advance in AI will lead, like every technological revolution before, to the same fateful turn, namely that the same technology that brings progress and productivity, the same technology will also turn this progress into its own opposite, into forces of dislocation, crisis, and destruction. Of course, this turn will have various forms we can't predict, but we could bring this fateful turn to the point with Marx's basic insight he had in regard to the nature of machines and of capitalist progress in general. We could bring the turn to the point with the conversion of necessary into surplus labor time I already have shown, and that according to which all machines produce always two things, surplus labor time and the surplus population. Like classical industrial machines produced surplus time from those who work, and an industrial reserve army by those made redundant, also the calculation machines of today and the AI to come, whatever they in the technical sense do and produce, on the level of valorization will produce two things only, surplus labor time and a surplus proletariat or a surplus population. We can generalize this turn to what I think turned out to be nothing less than the main contradiction of capitalist society, that the progress on the side of scientific and technological development does not correspond a progress in the social. The technical progress does not correspond to emancipatory forces or movements or an emancipatory consciousness. We, on the contrary, see already that the new technologies of digitization and internet, that Facebook, social media, and all these new technologies go hand in hand with the worldwide social regress by an increase of religious and populist politics, conspiracy theories, etc., corresponding to what in the age of industrial mass communication 100 years ago have been, coming at the end back to my beginning with Freud, the mass psychology of fascism. Thank you very much.